Hello, and welcome to episode 61 of the Sci-Fi Podcast. From Bloomington, Indiana, I'm Nick Stoutra. On today's podcast, I am pleased to welcome Dr. David Papineau, Professor of Philosophy at King's College London and the City University of New York Graduate Center. David's research spans metaphysics, epistemology, and the philosophies of science, mind, and mathematics. He is one of the originators of the teleosemantic theory of mental representation, a solution to the problem of intentionality, which derives the intentional content of our beliefs, that is, what our beliefs are about or are directed toward, from their biological purpose. David served as the president of the British Society for the Philosophy of Science from 1993 to 1995, president of the Mind Association from 2009 to 2010, and the president of the Aristotelian Society from 2013 to 2014. His latest book, Knowing the Score, How Sports Teach Us About Philosophy and Philosophy About Sports, looks at a number of ways in which sporting issues cast light on longstanding philosophical problems. And thus, without further ado, let's bring in David. Dr. David Papineau, welcome to the Sci-Fi Podcast. How are you this afternoon?
I'm very well, and I'm glad to be on your podcast.
I'm very happy to have you, and it's a pleasure to get to meet and chat with you. How are things in England?
In fact, I've just got here from the States today. It's a beautiful day, I'm looking forward to a nice weekend.
Fantastic. Were you in the States for some vacation or a business trip of sorts?
No, I spend the spring semester each year now at the CUNY Graduate Center in New York.
Oh, yeah.
And so I'm there kind of beginning of February through till mid end May, and I come back every while to see my family. My family comes to see me there. So this weekend I'm back in the UK.
Great. And so, yeah, so you do, so February to mid-May at City University of New York, and is the fall term or summer terms at King's College London, is that right?
At King's, in the fall. So I teach the first semester at King's and the second semester at CUNY. That's been going on for about 5 years now. It works pretty well.
Yeah, yeah. Before we go on, I'm curious. Yeah, how has this arrangement been for you in terms of teaching at two completely different universities every year?
So it works pretty well. I mean, I teach a course at King's in the autumn, maybe an undergraduate course and a master's course. I teach a course at the Graduate Center at CUNY, and I have PhD students in both places, and I kind of look after them all year long. So while at any one time I'm being played by one place or the other, it's not like I down tools for that place as soon as they stop paying me, and I look after the research students by Skype or FaceTime. It in fact works perfectly well. Works well.
Good to hear. Good to hear. Are you a fan of the city of New York?
Yes, I've always spent time there. And when I started doing this, I wondered, am I going to feel a bit strange in a kind of alien place for months on end? But in fact, I felt completely at home from the start. I have a lot of friends in New York. My sister lives in New York. Okay. And as I said, my family comes over. I mean, my wife, my two kids, variously, they come over for a few days every so often, and I kind of feel at home there.
Oh, good to hear. Good to hear. Well, interested in learning more about how we got to this point, but David, let's take a step back, and let's start back from the beginning. So tell us a little bit about your origin story. Where did you grow up?
So I grew up all over the place.
Okay.
My parents, I mean, I'm English, I'm British. My parents were both British. They were born in London. They both went to Oxford University. And then they got married during the war. They met in Cairo. And then all through my youth, they traveled around. So I was born in Italy, and I went to school a bit in England. Then I went to school in Trinidad in the West Indies. I mean, we lived there for three or 4 years. And then we were back in England. I lived in the north of England, in Rochdale, very northern Lancashire town. And
what brought about all this, all the travel?
My father just kept changing jobs. I mean, he was, I guess he had a bit of wanderlust. I mean, I think the war gave him a taste for foreign places. And we traveled. And then through my teenage years, we lived in South Africa, Durban, South Africa, from the age of about 9 till I was 20 when I left. So I went to high school there, Durban High School, and then I did my first degree at the University of Natal in Durban. I went to university very early. I was just 16 when I started university there, and I did maths and statistics for 4 years at University of Natal, and then
what was it like over? What was it like? Is it Natal? You said University of Natal. Okay.
What was it like? It was a strange place. I mean, it was a interesting place to grow up, but it was the height of apartheid South Africa, so it wasn't by any means a kind of idyll or a paradise.
Sure.
I mean, yeah, I was one of the privileged whites, but by the time I got university, I knew it was all wrong, and it was kind of slightly dangerous. I mean, some of my friends went to jail, and in fact, one bunch of friends was infiltrated by a police spy. They were a communist cell, and the police spy infiltrated them. And I remember him being kind of very kind to me once and driving me home and talking to me. And but I wasn't directly involved, partly because I was so young. I think, to their credit, my friends didn't think of involving me. As I said, I was just 16 years old. So, it was an interesting place.
I can only imagine. Yeah. So you mentioned, during that time, I mean, it must've been, especially at 16. So you said you were 16 and, spending time with, I imagine, some, you know, older students, older friends. How did you make sense of a little bit of what was going on at the time, the social climate, the environment?
I can't remember when I became politically aware, but certainly by the time I was at university, I thought it was, I knew it was all terrible, all wrong.
Yeah.
I hoped it would change. I guess one thing it's given me is a healthy disrespect for authority and strong concern for civil liberties. South Africa was a curious place. It had the kind of rule of law and the government, the apartheid government kind of didn't think they could just ride roughshod over the law. They were torturers and assassins in the police, but it wasn't by any means a completely lawless place. And so we were very aware of, when they brought in the 90 Days Detention Act, so they overrode habeas corpus and gave themselves the power to hold people in detention without trial, was a big thing. That was awful. But nowadays we find that my own country, Britain, is bringing and has various such laws, and I find it very disturbing that they just go through on the nod. I mean, things that the apartheid South African government was regarded as outrageous for doing is now taken to be part of normal civil society. I mean, I find that disturbing.
Yeah, yeah, I can imagine. Sure. So in growing up in this very complicated, social structure, and something that, yeah, you come later on to, or, you know, while doing to make sense of it. I suppose, yeah, what, you know, did that have any impact or effect on, I suppose, your interests or your field of study? Or was this something that was kind of going on in the background as you were, you know, focusing and beginning to focus on things like mathematics?
It wasn't that brought me into philosophy. And there was a level at which my family, as I said, we're all from Britain. I knew I was going to be going back to Britain. In fact, I mean, I went back before the rest of my family. I went back when I was 20, 1968, but the rest of them followed a couple of years later. So while, I mean, those years had a big formative effect on me, it wasn't that I became South African. So, but because of the political climate, a lot of my friends were reading existentialism and French philosophy, and they were encouraging me to get interested and various Marxist theorists, and none of that did much for me, really. I read it, but it didn't kind of go in. And then by chance, my father had done philosophy. He'd done PP, Philosophy, Politics, and Economics at Oxford. And he had a book by A.J. Ayer on his shelves, Language, not Language, Truth, and Logic, The Problem of Knowledge. And I started reading that. And I thought, this is the good stuff. This is for me. And I really found that a natural thing to be interested in. So I'd been doing maths, and I kind of felt, I mean, I wanted to carry on at that stage academically, and I kind of felt I want to do something a bit more, a bit less abstract and dry. I mean, at the time, and for some while, I told myself, you know, I quit doing maths because I wanted to do something more interesting. In retrospect, it wasn't really for me. I mean, I was good at it in the sense that I could understand all lectures very easily. I could do the problems. I could get top marks in the exams. But I was never going to do research in mathematics. It never grabbed in a way that I would start wondering about, you know, how this field would could I prove this? Did this follow from that? I never thought about those kinds of things in my spare time. But and then I started reading my last couple of years kind of English-speaking analytic philosophy and also quite a lot of psychology. I wasn't sure which of those I wanted to do. I started applying to English universities, and in fact, I ended up choosing to go to Cambridge to do philosophy, but partly because there was a kind of psychology option within the philosophy degree. In fact, I ended up not doing it. I just at that point switched to philosophy.
What was drawing you into this like psychological space?
I think I just wanted to understand things. I wanted to understand how things worked. And so I've always been interested in economics, social science, but the issues there were much more empirical and untractable. I mean, psychology is empirical, but I had kind of had the feeling that you could kind of nail things down there. And similarly in philosophy. So it was just general intellectual curiosity that I think took me away from maths and into other subjects. And I mean, there's always a question. I mean, is it a matter of chance you've ended up?
Yeah.
Should you have taken a different turn? But in retrospect, I think I really am a natural philosopher. I mean, not to say I'm hugely, I'm not looking about whether I'm good at it, but sure, I like doing it. I mean, sometimes I think, I mean, I'm quite interested in the law, and and I mean, I know people who study law, and they say, "Oh no, it's so boring, all those details." But in fact, I'm rather interested in those details. I like talking to lawyers about rather, you know, minute points of precedent and case law and so on.
Yeah.
And so sometimes I think, well, you know, perhaps I should have been, you know, I could have been a lawyer. Perhaps that would have been a different term. It wasn't something I really thought of at the stage when I would have been natural to do it. But in retrospect, I sometimes think, well, perhaps I should. But I think that if I had done that, I would have naturally gravitated towards being an academic lawyer, being a jurist, trying to think about it from a kind of abstract, non-practical point of view. And I might have ended up being an academic philosopher of law, in which case I may as well just have started off, carried on being a philosopher. So I switched to philosophy. I went to Cambridge and I did a second first degree. There was an arrangement you could do, get a BA in philosophy in 2 years if you had a previous degree in a different subject. And so that's the option I took. And And I've been doing it ever since. And I never really had any real doubts that this was a good thing for me to be doing.
Fantastic. Okay. Well, so I noticed, yeah, so here you did your second undergrad. You said, so you did a philosophy undergrad at Cambridge. And then what was the second one in?
So the first degree was in maths and mathematical statistics. Second degree was 2 years, first degree. It was, in fact, at that time called moral sciences. It was the moral science tripos. That was just a quaint Cambridge archaic thing. In fact, it was changed quite soon after I finished there to philosophy, but it was just a philosophy degree. I mean, it had started off the moral science tripos, as philosophy, economics, and maybe psychology. Mm-hmm. But economics and psychology had gone off to form their own degrees by then, and so the only moral science left was philosophy. I think by the end of the 70s, it was called philosophy. So, but that was interesting because at that time there was a curious arrangement in the Cambridge moral science philosophy degree, which is that you had to either do history and ethics and political philosophy, what the Germans call practical philosophy, or you had to do, it wasn't just theoretical philosophy, it was pretty sciencey theoretical philosophy. So the papers I did in my final year, if I can remember, were mathematical logic, philosophical logic, philosophy of mathematics, and philosophy of science. Mm-hmm. So very logic, science-oriented option of philosophy. And the setup was that you either had to do those papers or you had to do ethics and history, and no overlap. I mean, it suited me fine, but it was a pretty strange system. And in fact, they changed that too pretty soon.
So what brought about then, I guess, the decision then to go on to the PhD with, I see here, a PhD in conceptual change and scientific rationality. So a pretty strong shift in focus toward, I imagine, philosophy of science.
So, well, as you can see, I mean, I was already, along with a lot of my peers, focused on philosophy of science in my undergraduate program. In the last year, we were told you do philosophy of science or you do ethics, and I was doing philosophy of science. In fact, I was enjoying it. I was doing well. It was perfectly natural to go on and do a PhD. In those days, you went straight into a PhD and from the BA. So I I mean, now it would seem strange. There I did 2 years of philosophy. And in my last year, a lot of it was pretty techy mathematical logic stuff. And 2 years of that. And then straight into the PhD, 3 years of the PhD. And then I had a job. So my philosophical education was just 5 years long. In retrospect, rather thin. I mean, I've often had to do quite a lot of catching up in my later career.
Tell us about that. Yeah, so I'm from someone who's come from the sciences and has recently joined philosophy. I feel like I'm constantly catching up. So by catching up, what do you mean?
Well, I didn't do any ancient philosophy as an undergraduate. I didn't do any history of philosophy as an undergrad. Mm-hmm. I never read anything. I wasn't required to read anything before Russell on Denoting. I think Frege, the Foundations of Arithmetic. But that was as far back as I was required to go. So the huge areas of the history of philosophy, which I mean, I kind of you need for your general education, for your philosophical bearings. I had to catch up on that, and various parts of what I regard as basic metaphysics. I never really did as a student. So there were just a lot of gaps. I mean,
sure.
But when I started the PhD, the original idea, I worked with Ian Hacking, but the reason I was going to work with him, because I was going to work on the logic of statistical inference. That was, I don't know if you know this area at all. Well, so that was back in the day where, it's strange to me now. I mean, I think back, so we're talking the end of the 60s. So time gets old. I mean, it was quite not that long after Fisher and Neyman and Pearson had set up the kind of methodology of significance tests. And if you ask me, very flawed methodology. And Ian Hacking, who was my supervisor and a wonderful polymath, he started off worrying about logical significance tests, and he pointed out a whole lot of oddities in the way statisticians thought about methodology, incoherences. And I mean, at that time, now and then we looked at Bayesianism as an alternative, but it really wasn't considered a live option. It was considered pretty freaky and kind of fringy. But that's when I started off. I mean, I didn't have any definite ideas either. I mean, that time you went into PhD, I thought, you know, I'll study this a bit, and then something will occur to me. In fact, nothing much did occur to me, and I got very interested in Kuhn and Feyerabend. That was all the fashion at the time, and so I ended up doing my PhD on that, on theory dependence of observation, incommensurability, and the basic idea. I mean, my first book, Theory and Meaning, was my PhD, was that I accepted, absorbed an awful lot about what Kuhn and Feyerabend said about meaning and observation, but tried to show that there was still room for scientific objectivity. It was pretty juvenile piece of work, it now seems to me, but I mean, I got into some interesting things. So anyway, and I stay with Ian Hacking. He remained my supervisor through that period. And so I finished the PhD. Well, after 3 years, my funding ran out.
Sure.
And I needed a job. The job I got was in a sociology department.
Really?
Yeah, at the University of Reading. And it was perfectly respectable middle rank British university, and it was a very interesting sociology department. The professor was a man called Stanislav Andreski, mm-hmm. who was a Pole. He'd been a Polish officer in the war. He had lots of interesting stories. He was from the logical empiricist Polish tradition and was interested in sociology, but was very much for him a kind of comparative business. You try to formulate laws, you see if they applied across different societies, you use Mill's methods of agreement and difference. And he thought there should be a philosopher hired in the sociology department to teach the students that kind of methodological thing. In fact, I taught them a lot of Kuhn and Feyerabend and so on. But he was a fine fellow. He had lots of interesting stories. He said that he was with the Polish army when the Russians captured them, and he saw which way the wind was blowing, and he took the stripes off his sleeves and mixed in with the ranks, and the rest of his officer colleagues were all taken off to Katyn. And but he hired that department a lot of East European emigres and refugees. So it was a terribly interesting department. We had people who around the time of the war had been in Poland and Yugoslavia and Czechoslovakia, and had a kind of range of knowledge which wasn't normal in 1970s Britain. And it was very educational for me. I learned a lot of social science. I learned a lot of stuff I hadn't known before.
How was getting introduced to all these, very interesting people in this new discipline, did this impact your work at all in terms of in the philosophy that you were doing? Did you start adopting, these other social science methods or applying philosophy in a different way?
Not hugely. I mean, I became more educated. I became quite educated. I mean, the classic founding fathers of sociology, Durkheim, Weber, Marx. I mean, I got to know a lot about them. I'm not sure that's fed directly into my philosophical work, but it's certainly a big part of my worldview. I thought a lot about the methodology of empirical research in the social sciences, and particularly about the use of statistics to infer causal structure. And I worked on that quite a lot. I've always been interested in that. I'm still hoping to rectify this, but I haven't ever written as much about it as I would have liked to. But that's now become a mainstream approach to causation in the philosophy of science and practical disciplines as well. But back then, it was something peculiar to sociometricians and econometricians, and philosophers just weren't interested. I mean, they were all doing David Lewis kind of factual analyses of causation. And I tried a few times, and I was saying, look, here's this really interesting thing. If you have a correlation and it's screened off by some other variable, then that shows you that the other variable is the common cause of the two originally correlated things. And where's the theory of causation that explains why that works? And that wasn't something philosophers could really get to grips with much. I mean, later on, there were probabilistic theories of causation, SUPIs, which were in that ballpark, but it's become much more mainstream now. But anyway, I'm digressing. So we were back with the Department of Sociology. I mean, right. What I did is I lectured on the philosophy of social sciences, and that was a time when it was a kind of well-defined subject with a canonical set of problems, and I gave my lectures for 4 years, and then my second book was a version of those lectures. It was called For Science in the Social Sciences. It was a kind of what in those times was called a kind of defense of positivism that I wanted the social sciences to adopt.
Hmm.
Scientific methods, but I can't remember what were the chapters of the book. It was something about objectivity, something about causation of statistics, something about the role of embarrassingly, there was a chapter called Men and History, which is about, you know, do individuals make a difference to the course of history? And somebody said to me a decade or so ago, what do you think you were doing?
Right.
Men and history. And I said, well, truth is that most people talk like that then. It's kind of embarrassing in retrospect, but it wasn't like I was at all out of line with general enlightened ways of talking about these matters.
Sure.
It was a long time ago. So that was my second book. It was stuff about facts and values, about alien belief systems. I mean, it was a standard set of topics that we used to do.
Okay. What, you know, could you say, like, if there was, like, one big takeaway from the book, what would that be?
Not sure there was. I mean, perhaps the most original bit was the stuff about causation and statistics and the use of statistics to derive causal conclusions, which, as I said, was not something that was at the center of philosophical thinking about causation at all. And I wrote a few papers based on that. But I didn't go as far with it as I now wish I could have. And I'm hoping to go back to that in a year or two and try and write some stuff and maybe a book on the connection in causation and statistics. So that's kind of what I've taken away from that.
Fair enough.
Mostly. I mean, and also there was the issue of holism and individualism in the social sciences, which was very much like the issue that we have in philosophy of mind between physicalism and dualism. I mean, there was a view, the Durkheimian view, that there were social facts, and Durkheimians talked about social facts very realistically as something ontologically distinct from facts about individuals that controlled them, and it's a kind of weird metaphysical view, but some people used to take that seriously in those days, and it was very analogous to dualism and philosophy of mind, which in addition to the brain processes, you have extra conscious facts, perhaps making a difference to what goes on in the brain. And it's interesting, I kind of analyzed this and argued against the Durkheimian sociological dualism, using pretty much the same kind of arguments that people use in the philosophy of mind to argue against kind of Cartesian dualism nowadays, namely that you're already explaining everything in the mind-brain case in terms of brain processes. If you bring in some extra stuff, there's going to be no causal work left for it to do. And I use just the same argument against Durkheimian dualism. You can explain everything in terms of what individuals and groups of individuals in interaction are doing. And once you've done that, there's nothing left for these supposed Durkheimian social facts to explain. So that was kind of interesting.
Yeah, absolutely. So, so I know. I mean, you obviously have quite a varied career. What came next in your academic research and your stuff? Yeah. So we were working in the sociology department. What eventually got you back into the philosophy department?
I'm just trying to think. I mean, I kind of was already reading for 4 years. I was in no desperate hurry. I mean, in retrospect, it's a bit puzzling because it wasn't the most. No, I was perfectly happy with the job. And perfectly ambitious, but I didn't kind of feel I had to get out in a hurry. And at the time, if they were nice jobs, I was living in Cambridge. My partner at the time was an architect there, and so when there were jobs in Cambridge, I applied for them. So I applied for a philosophy of science job, I remember, when I was at Reading. But I also applied for a social sciences job in Cambridge. So I wasn't desperate to get out of the social science department into philosophy. And then my partner and I thought we applied for jobs in Australia. She was from Australia. She was keen to go back. I thought, I don't like this English climate. I, in those terms, was much happier in South Africa. Let's go to Australia. So I got a job in Sydney, Australia, at Macquarie University, in the Department of Philosophy there. And I moved back more into mainstream philosophy at that point. And it was a good place to be doing philosophy. Sydney Philosophy Department was a great force then, with David Armstrong and David Stove and Michael Devitt, who is, I saw quite a lot of him when I was in Sydney. So that was for 3-4 years around 1980, 77 to 80. And Michael's still my colleague. He's my colleague in New York at CUNY now. So we've had quite a lot to do with each other over the years. But I was just there for 3-4 years. I hadn't realized how British I was until I went there. No, because I'd lived in South Africa, and then I went to Britain, and I didn't find that particularly disturbing or difficult. So I thought, well, I'll just go to Australia, and that will be the same. But it kind of didn't feel the same for me. I felt that I was in a faraway place. And, I mean, it's a wonderful place to live, wonderful place to work, and I've always regretted that I felt like that, because in many ways Sydney is the most delightful city in the world, and if I felt at home there, I would have enjoyed that. But I was keen to go back to Britain at that stage, or North America, but I got a job in Cambridge again. In the Department of History and Philosophy of Science in Cambridge, a very distinguished department, still very distinguished, in Free School Lane.
Yeah,
and I was there for 10 years.
What did you feel? Curious. Yeah, for this. Yeah, for the long time, sort of your first like real. Several other great positions at these other universities. What did you feel like you accomplished there in the HPS department? At Cambridge from 81 to 90, and as well, was there, it was the history and philosophy of science department, so was there any history going on then in terms of your work or your being influenced by that?
I got educated. I mean, I educated myself, so I said there were gaps in my philosophical education, but one of the courses I was given to teach was the history of the philosophy of science. So I taught, didn't really do Galileo for some reason. I started with Descartes. I did Descartes, and Newton and Locke and Hume and Berkeley and Whewell and some Kant. And I just read the text and a few secondary sources and try to make sense of it all. I mean, that was, in retrospect, pretty amazing thing to do. I mean, I didn't really have any training, and this was again at Cambridge University lectures. But in fact, I learned a lot. I think I understand those periods pretty well. I mean, so that was great for me. That was good for my education. But mostly, what I did in those years was figure out how to be a realist. So I wrote a book in 1987 called Reality and Representation. And that was just a result of my intellectual development through those years. Because when I'd started out doing my kind of Kuhn and Feyerabend and stuff and so on, philosophy of science was all Popperian in a strange way. I mean, this didn't happen so much in America, though I think of Kuhn as part of this tradition, but certainly in Britain, the dominant philosophical influence was Oxford, a bit of Cambridge, but Oxford, they didn't do science. All the philosophers did classics. And there was Popper out of the Vienna Circle at the LSE, and the view was, well, if you're doing philosophy of science, you go and listen to Popper. Mm-hmm. Thing was, Popper, I mean, it's clear now, but it wasn't clear then, was a pretty terrible philosopher. I mean, he had some really bad ideas. And in particular, about science, he was just an out-and-out skeptic. He didn't think scientific theories were true. He thought they were all fated to be disproved. He thought the best a scientific theory could do was to be precise enough to be disproved. And if you want to defend rationality against Kuhn and Feyerabend, your job was to show that scientific theories could be disproved on rational grounds, and it wasn't just a matter of fashion and opinion when people threw out one theory for another.
Right.
And both my first two books took this Popperian attitude to scientific objectivity. And it wasn't until I was into my 30s that, I mean, it's embarrassing now, that I realized this was just wrong. I mean, we ought to be able to believe sometimes theories. I mean, some of them are speculative. Some of them are only going to be approximately true. But look, I believe that matter is made of atoms. I believe there is a big thing. I mean, I don't regard that as a speculation that's going to turn out to be wrong. I regard that as something that's firmly established by the evidence. But if you're a Popperian, that kind of attitude wasn't on the agenda. Popper thought that belief was a psychological matter. Science wasn't interested in psychology. It was just interested in objective falsification. Anyway, it was all bad stuff. And interestingly, I'd been softened up for this kind of freeing myself from Popper by David Stove in Australia, in Sydney. He'd given some lectures called Four Irrationalists, Popper, and after he wrote a book about it, very scurrilous, very funny man. And he said, look, Popper's got ridiculous views. He doesn't think that science discovers anything. How can anybody take this man seriously? And I remember going to the lectures and thinking, isn't he missing the point? And I mean, there's some bad bits about Popper, but basically he's onto something good. And after I thought about it for a bit, I thought, no, the man is completely right. They've just exposed the emperor as having no clothes. And I've always resented that I wrote two books under Popper's influence and I wasn't able to see for myself how silly it was. So that was one thing, was to defend scientific realism against the skeptics. And then we know this kind of – Bas van Franssen is a skeptic about unobservable reality. So that was one side of it. Mm-hmm. But there was another kind of anti-realism that I was arguing against in that book, which is the kind of – neo-idealist brand of anti-realism, which doesn't deny science, but defends it by saying it's not really trying to make claims about an independent reality. The true theory is just theory we're led to by ideal rationality in the long run. So various kinds of epistemic theories of truth that made truth too easy, it seemed to me. So I was arguing for real realism against two foes, the kind of neo-idealists who said truth cannot be beyond what we're capable of verifying on the one hand, and the skeptics who said, look, there is an independent fact of the matter about whether our theories are true, and we can't know whether they're true. So, I mean, and at the time, these issues all seemed pretty clear-cut, and I guess most down-to-earth philosophers agree with the line I've just articulated. But certainly for me, in the 80s, it wasn't at all clear cut. In fact, I mean, as I said, there was Popper and van Franssen on one side, and on the neo-idealist side, there was a huge range of influences, including Michael Dummett, Donald Davidson, Hilary Putnam. They all had various kinds of epistemic theories of truth and meaning, and I wanted to argue against them too. So it took me quite a lot of time to figure these matters out, and that was the book I wrote in 87.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so sounds like a lot was going on, and how have you, I guess, in terms of looking back on it, how would you reflect on that work? What do you think of it?
I'm quite pleased with it. Well, I mean, I mean, the book's not very neat, and I wouldn't especially push people to go and read it now because it's very much of its time, and it's a matter of me working out how I was going to place myself, distance myself, what I believed in response to these two, as I saw it, threats to real realism. But one thing that came out of that is I became very interested in representation, the phenomenon of representation, mental representation, scientific representation. And I thought a lot about that, and it was a time when there was a lot of work in philosophy of mind, computationalism that was struggling with notions of representation, and I was involved in thinking about that and about Davidson's approach to representation. And I was drawn towards thinking about representation as a biological phenomenon. I started thinking about what's now come to be known as teleosemantics. And that came out of this. And that, for me, is the right way to see why what it is for a thought or a statement to be true is nothing to do with the procedures by which we establish the statement. First, I mean, truth is independent of methods of investigation. First, there's a statement. It's got truth conditions. That's all fixed. And then afterwards, you come along and you figure out how do you ascertain whether the truth conditions obtain or not. So I became very much a truth-first method afterwards person. And that's quite basic to my philosophy across quite a lot of areas of thought. Mm-hmm. So I got interested in representation. And then as a result of that, I became interested in issues in philosophy of mind and metaphysics. So I was looking at the mind and representation very much in the kind of computationalist tradition. The mind is mm-hmm. akin to a computer. I mean, I was never particularly attracted to the high church computationist ideology of sentences in the head and so on. But the basic materialist attitude was kind of important for me. And at that time in Britain, and still in Britain, materialism isn't really regarded as a healthy part of philosophy. Mm-hmm. It's somehow seen as kind of a bit vulgar. It shouldn't make any difference to philosophy. And is there really an issue of physicalism? And I felt there was. And I started arguing against my British colleagues, looking for arguments to convince them they had to be physicalists. So I became very interested in general issues of physicalism and associated metaphysics. So my next book in 1992, Philosophical Naturalism, was a defense of physicalism in general, a defense of teleosemantic theory of representation. And at that point, because I was a physicalist, I became interested in consciousness, because I mean, two of the big problems for physicalism is how do you account for meaning and how do you account for consciousness? And so that led me to think about the issues of consciousness and whether they're a problem.
Yeah.
And that became the absolute focus of my next book in 2003, thinking about consciousness.
Yeah. So it sounds like in your approach, I really like this kind of sequential. I came about this idea, but then I learned about this. So then I had to go do this, and then I came, but then this happened. And so I became interested in this.
Yeah.
I admire and appreciate this kind of engagement, of starting in philosophy of science and then kind of weaving through metaphysics, philosophy of mind, in terms of your process for doing philosophy, is this kind of sort of the way in which you've kind of learned to do things? Is kind of just follow the questions, follow your nose, so to speak?
So I'm not sure it's a recipe for doing the best philosophy.
Sure.
I think perhaps people do better, more penetrating, more precise work when they have their own field and they plow it and they carry on doing it. And you know, sometimes I wish I'd worked like that, but I can't help it. I mean, I like to have philosophical views about anything. And I mean, that's not the real motivation. I mean, what happens is you're working on one philosophical problem and then you realize that you need to have some views about a related topic, and you can get interested in that. So, I mean, as I said, I mean, consciousness, I can remember starting to think, oh, what about consciousness? If I'm going to be a physicalist, what about consciousness? And so, I mean, I hadn't really thought about consciousness before that. And so I started looking at arguments. I started developing some arguments of my own, and so it went on. I mean, having said that, you know, you can do good philosophy just sticking to one topic. I'm not sure that's a healthy strategy. But sometimes, I've got to evaluate young philosophers in various contexts in my jobs, and sometimes you can have somebody who's kind of, pretty good, got some good papers, but I think not enough problems. Not enough problems. I mean, I don't especially warm to philosophers who, they've been working for 10 years and all their papers have just been on one topic. I'd like to see people who have views about a number of different topics.
Sure. Well, so perhaps before we get into some of your current work, you could, reflect on if there is one collection of work or sort of area over your career that perhaps has been the most influential on your thinking and or has been the most influential on the field as a whole. What might that be? And could you tell us a little bit about it?
Well, that's difficult. So I think we're thinking about representation, about pseudo-semantics.
If we have to draw back to perhaps a topic or something, just to fill us in a little bit more about it, that's totally fine too.
So, the person who's done the most work on pseudo-semantics is Ruth Millikan, and right. She's a very powerful philosopher, and I've learned a lot from her. I mean, not especially about pseudo-semantics, but about her general metaphysical vision of the world. But still, I've been more interested in representation in the context of thinking about scientific realism. And so I'm pleased about what I did with that. But more recently, that was back in the 80s, early 90s. More recently, I've been working on physicalism and consciousness. And I feel I kind of stand by a lot of that. And I kind of think I've got it right, whereas a lot of other people in this area have got it wrong. In fact, I'm writing a paper right now. Uh-huh. I mean, I'm writing it before you phone me up, and I'm going to carry on writing it. Talking, explaining why David Chalmers thinks about consciousness all wrong. And I mean, I've done that a number of times, but I'm going to do it again. And I think I've called him out on a mistake this time. So,
could you give us the shorthand version of why Chalmers is all wrong? If you would not like to reveal it.
So he, what I'm saying is that he conflates the fact that everybody finds consciousness puzzling, which I think is just because something forces people to resist materialism and think in dualistic terms. It's just a kind of intuition of dualism. Mm-hmm. He alludes to that a lot and talks about it, but he conflates it with some rather obscure and complicated semantic issues about the relation between the way we talk about consciousness and talk about the brain, and I think that's a completely different thing. Now, the paper that he's just written, called The Meta Problem of Consciousness, focuses specifically on the fact that people intuitively think in dualistic terms, but he still seems to think that that's something to do with his complicated two-dimensional semantics and the difficulty of deriving conscious claims from physical claims. And I think he's been pushing that for 30 years, been very influential, and I think it's all a bad mistake. So, and I've been pushing that line for a long time.
Right.
So
you've been pushing the line for a while. Is there anything you hope to, you know, further accomplish in this new paper? Is this going to be something that just kind of clearly articulates this view or a responds to a new, you know, sort of a new, this new paper by Chalmers?
No, this is just another skirmish in a long engagement.
Yeah.
So I have a strange relationship to epistemology. So I used to think of myself as doing epistemology. My first book was about scientific objectivity and how is it possible to get at scientific knowledge. So I explained for Popperian reasons I wasn't thinking about scientific knowledge the right way. But I've stopped calling myself an epistemologist because of the weird turn that subject area has taken. It's kind of gone away from any issues to do with how should we think, I mean, what method should we use to get at the truth, and does this rather strange thing, which is, I mean, analyzing the concept of knowledge. Well, that went on in the 60s and 70s, and everybody thought that that was a bit ridiculous. But strangely, epistemologists are still doing something very similar. They spend a lot of time trying to lay out the geography of our intuitive notions of knowledge, evidence, justification, and so on.
Right.
And I was kind of said, look, well, I don't really believe in this subject. I can't see what these people are doing, so I'm not an epistemologist. But nevertheless, from time to time, I've written papers kind of sniping at this business from the side, saying, I don't really understand what you're doing. I don't see what kind of normativity is involved here. And I've just written a paper which is a head-on attack on the concept of knowledge. I mean, I've thought this for a long time, but I've never really had a good way of arguing it. But I think I've now got a way of arguing. I started the paper by saying that the concept of knowledge, it's a Bertrand Russell joke about causation. Concept of knowledge is a relic of a bygone age, surviving only because, like the monarchy, it's erroneously thought to do no harm. But the paper is called The Disvalue of Knowledge, and in the paper I argue that it's not just philosophers. People in general are being their thinking is being messed up by being concerned with knowledge. All they should be concerned with is how to get at true belief. And that's a paper I've got quite excited about over the last few months. So that's something else I'm pleased with.
Mm-hmm.
I'm finishing a book now on perception, which is very much focused on the twin issues of consciousness and representation. And standard view in philosophy of perception is representationist view of perception. And I didn't used to think about perception very much. I've only started thinking about the last half dozen years, maybe a bit longer.
Mm-hmm.
And once I started working on it, I mean, I got into it for rather specific reasons. I mean, I was driven. There was something I was thinking. Thinking, and I thought that's not consistent with what the people in the philosophy of perception think, and so I started looking at what they thought, and I came to the view what they think is all wrong, and I think I can see why it's wrong, because I thought so much separately about representation and about consciousness, and I've written a couple of papers on that, and the book should be finished this year. That should be pretty good stuff. I'm pleased with that, and I say they're all wrong. All the philosophers of perception are really very wrong.
Really?
The representationalists are really wrong, and the direct realists are also really wrong. The view I defend is, in fact, the view I think that most intelligent people outside the philosophy of perception hold, whether they be high school students or philosophers working in other areas, but it's not ever been spelt out and articulated because the people inside the philosophy of perception, I don't know why, all have very weird views. So that's what I'm finishing at the moment.
Mm-hmm.
But after that, I want to go back to the issue of causation. And I want to go back to the connection between statistics and causation, which now, because of the work of Clark Gleamore and Jim Woodward, is at the center of thinking about causation. But I think I can develop a metaphysical theory of causation that hinges on the kind of statistical understanding that's now coming into focus. And most people who work in that area aren't really interested in fundamental metaphysics. So, but that's a project for the next 2, 3, 4 years.
Yeah. Okay. Well, let's. I'm curious to ask about perhaps a more popular book you've been, I'm sure, asked about, Knowing the Score, How Sports Teach Us About Philosophy and Philosophy About Sports. So you've done a number of interviews here, a number of really cool news, even meeting with sports teams, it seems like, or at least doing talks. Tell us a little bit about how you came to work on this project and what it's involved and what it's brought about.
So it was kind of pretty happenstantial. So I've always, I've always played a lot of sport. I'm a big sports fan, but I never really put it together with philosophy. And to be honest, there are people who work in the philosophy of sport, but I've always found that a rather pedestrian. Looks at issues like why is sport important, doping in sport, and so on. Having said that, I'm about to be on a panel at the LSE on Monday. I mean, that's one of the reasons I'm back in England at the moment, talking about doping in sport, and I hope we can manage to make it interesting. Anyway, I've never really been interested in philosophy of sport, but what happened about 5 years ago is I built myself a website. I mean, only because I had a perfectly good website kind of inside the King's College website back in the days where we were allowed to kind of build our own departmental websites. And then, as is happening all over the world, the corporate managers have taken over the college website. So I thought, I'll go off and make myself an independent website. And it had a blogging facility. And I thought, I'll blog about something. And my wife, who's a journalist, she said, look, if you're going to blog, you've got to have a niche. You can't just give the world your thoughts about Brexit and climate warning and where you're going for dinner and so on. It's not going to be interesting. Nobody's going to listen. You've got to have something that's peculiar to your blog. And I thought, well, I had been thinking about how did I get into it? It was partly because I had a student working on Liebert, and the idea that consciousness does not control our actions. So I kind of got interested in how far does consciousness control our actions and how far doesn't it? And I got rather interested in the context of thinking about that, about sporting examples, because they're cases of very complex, sophisticated, skilled actions where consciousness can't possibly be playing any role because they happen so fast. And that, a baseball batter hitting a baseball or a cricketer hitting a cricket ball. And so I got very interested in skills in the context of sport. And I felt I could show some things relevant to the general philosophy of action and skills by appealing to the sporting examples that I knew about.
Mm-hmm.
So I my first blog post was just about that. It was, I think it was called Choking and the Yips. It was about distinguishing choking from the yips. It's two kinds of mental failure that sportsmen and women can succumb to. And but I thought I had this interesting thing to say, and it was a combination of philosophy and sport, and I thought a lot of people should be interested, because a lot of people are interested in philosophy, a lot of people are interested in sport. And once I did the first one, I mean, in fact, before I'd done the first one, I realized that there were quite a lot of topics
mm-hmm.
where either some philosophical ideas could illuminate what was going on in sport, or as often, some sporting phenomenon could cast light on some familiar philosophical problem. I thought it was kind of the sporting examples as a kind of high-energy particle accelerator. It showed us how humans behave in extreme circumstances could illuminate things that weren't illuminated otherwise. So I started doing this blog, and I did about 20 blogs, and then there was quite a lot of attention. Some publishers came and said, "Do you want to make it into a book?" So I did, and that's what happened. It was a lot of fun.
That's fantastic. Did you talk to any, in terms of like gathering the information and reflecting on sport? I mean, was it just like your own, you know, personal experience participating in and or watching sports? Or did you talk with any players or coaches or things?
I talked a bit. I was in a couple of, you know, debates with, I was in a debate with the English cricket captain at one point. I talked more to sports psychologists, because that's right. Especially in Australia, but it's kind of spread. The Australian Academy of Sports Science started it. There's a lot of very detailed and surprising investigations into how athletes do the amazing things they do. And
So
all the standard demonstrations about how their eyes don't do what you think they do. It's the same in cricket and baseball. You know, if you're a kid, you're told to keep your eyes on the ball.
Mm-hmm.
That's not what they do at all.
Mm-hmm.
They circade their eyes away from the ball to where they think it's going to be. There's all the stuff about how – so the great athletes, often when you watch them, they have a lot of time. I mean, I haven't watched much ice hockey, but Wayne Gretzky I watched once. I mean, and you could see which one he was, because he seemed to be kind of moving in slow motion. I mean, he just didn't have to be rushed. And doesn't really apply with baseball batters, but cricketers, the great batsmen, they seem just to be so unhurried. I mean, they're doing something, you know, within less than a half a second, but... And it emerges, the reason is because they know where the ball's going to go long before the pitcher or the opponent releases it or hits it, because they can tell from the angle of their wrist and the turn of their shoulders exactly what the other person's going to do. So it's all anticipation. So the sports scientists have been developing that for some years, and that was quite influential for me in writing the book in parts of it. But it ranges over a number of things. It doesn't just range over fast sporting skills. It ranges over the fandom. I talk about teams. I talk about cheating and gamesmanship. But I'm always relating it to more general philosophical issues.
Right. Yeah, I see. There's a number of really great chapters here. So there's some political philosophy going on. There's some ethics. There's some philosophy of science. There's some decision theory, things like that.
Exactly.
Yeah. Have you found that you know, you've come to appreciate sport and or think of sport in a different way after having written this book?
I don't know. I guess. I mean, I always find it satisfying when I see some sporting event or incident that backs up what was in the book. And you know, my friends will kind of text me saying, "Did you see that one? That was just what you were saying." But the book was being published, so I kind of closed down the blog because all the book was on the blog. The publisher said, "Just don't leave it there." That one.
Right.
And I've thought from time to time about, you know, restarting it, but I've got a bunch of other topics, and I might do that in a while. But what am I? I mean, I'm using my time now doing serious philosophy.
Right.
I'm enjoying that just as much. I mean, I enjoy doing the book, but I find the more natural thing for me to do is just write academic philosophy. That's what I like doing.
Fantastic. I see you mentioned, so did you argue, I know like this is a common, you know, discussion, philosophical discussion of understanding what is a sport. Is that something you, and I've noticed you've done a podcast regarding is bridge a sport? What are your thoughts on these kinds of games like bridge and poker and other things, and of whether they would include and be a sport? This is sort of a long-standing discussion that many people have in terms of trying to understand what is a sport.
I have very, very definite views on it. So it's the last chapter of the book. So I said, look, when I started off, I was going to do something kind of more interesting, more sexy than traditional topics in the philosophy of sport.
Yeah.
And so I never really wanted to do the nature and value of sport. Actually, now I remember how I got into this topic. Uh-huh. I was asked to give a lecture in a series back in 2011. It was before the London Olympics, Royal Institute of Philosophy. I was going to have a series of philosophers talking about sport, and I thought, right, okay, I'd always avoided the topic, but Anthony O'Hare, the chair of the society, twisted my arm a bit, and I said, sure, look, I'm interested in the sport, I'm interested in philosophy, I'll have a go. And I started trying to say something about the nature and value of sport, and it was just getting nowhere. It was so boring. So I put that to one side, and I talked in the lecture about fast sporting skills, where I thought I did have something interesting to say. So that's how I got started on these topics. But when I wrote the book, I did finally write a chapter at the end on the nature and value of sport. And in fact, I did get interested in the topic, and I could have done this in the original lecture, and then perhaps I would never have had the blog and I took issue with what's rather popular view about the nature of sport and so on, which is Bernard Suit's book, The Grasshopper, and he's got a whole theory of games, and it's a very good theory of games, but it's not a good theory of sport, because games are one thing. It's kind of games are things that involve arbitrary rules and so on. And sports are another. And you could do the Venn diagram. Some sports are games, and some sports aren't games. Some games are sports, and some games aren't sports. So what makes something a game is it's got arbitrary rules. What makes something a sport is to do with the exercise of physical skills. Sports all to do with physical skills. Physical skills are things that people care about. They enjoy them. They value them. It's very natural to human beings to develop and take pride in your physical skills. And I think that's what sport's all about. And I think it fits all the cases pretty well. A sport is any activity that's devoted to the exercise of physical skills for their own sake.
Right. So, because you have something. So you have
bridge and poker. I've played a lot of both bridge and poker, and very, very worthwhile and admirable pastimes involving high degrees of skill.
Sure.
But they aren't physical skill. There's no way that bridge involves physical skill. So, same with chess. I mean, and there's an easy way to demonstrate it. You could play bridge, and if, say, you were paralyzed or something, you could get somebody else to play the cards for you, and it would right. still be you playing. But if there's a sport, however unathletic it might seem, see, I think darts is a sport. I think snooker is a sport. I think archery is a sport. I mean, they're not very athletic physical skills, but they're physical skills. And it doesn't make sense for somebody else to throw the darts for you. Then it's not you playing anymore. So it's perfectly clear. Bridge is not a sport.
Yeah, it is true that these other particular activities allow for additional. Well, I like this. I like the example of you could get somebody. You could be accommodated to play in some other kind of way. But I mean, at the same time, there is so making sense of then. So certain, you know, I know like competitive chess. I don't play chess competitively, but I've studied it. I've followed it. That sometimes matches can go for, you know, 5, 7, 10 hours. And that the best chess champions do have like a physical exercise regimen outside of the game in order to prepare them for being mentally focused and prepared. So, you know, sitting down with a friend to play chess, of course, that's fine. But the true tournament players require some physical skill. But it's more of on the physical skill toward preparing themselves to play the game as opposed to developing a physical skill. I see maybe like a reason to want to separate that from something like, you know, cricket or something.
I haven't really, that might put pressure on my definition because of course many sports, I'd say probably all sports involve some element of mental skill. I mean, you need certain mental powers to be a competitive athlete. So when the bridge and chess involves some element of physical skill, well,
maybe more competitive chess, competitive bridge, things like that.
Have you heard of chess boxing?
No.
It started off as a performance art joke, but it's kind of, I mean, I don't think it's ever really going to take off because it's so weird. But chess boxing is alternating rounds of boxing with moves on the chessboard. And you win either by knocking out your opponent or by checkmating them.
Incredible!
You can see the tactics. You don't want your brain to get too addled in the boxing ring because you might make a false move in between. So it's, you know, a 3-minute round of boxing, and then 5 minutes at the chessboard with so many moves required. And there are tournaments. You look it up.
I have to watch. This is incredible. Yeah, no, I have some fans who are fans of chess and as well as fans of boxing, and this is an incredible sport. I will certainly be watching this video after our interview concludes. Great. Well, before we take up so much of your time, let's get to that final question and shift gears. Thank you for entertaining my questions related to sport, but let's get back to the last question related to sort of an overview of philosophy of science and your take on what you take to be the greatest challenge facing philosophy of science today.
I don't know if I've got a challenge for philosophy of science in itself. I mean,
sure.
I think philosophy of science is pretty healthy at the moment. I think the all kinds of aspects of science and scientific practice and scientific methods that raise philosophical issues, I think philosophers are doing great work in engaging with them. I mean, if there's a danger, I think it's a danger not just philosophy of science, but philosophy more generally, and perhaps other aspects of academic life and life beyond the universities, is things can become overly specialized. Perhaps this is a result of the kind of information overload that we're all living with in the modern world. So much is published, so much detailed work is done that people can't really do work at the highest level in very many areas, because you need to read an awful lot and absorb an awful lot to be at the cutting edge in any particular area. And I think that's a pity. It leads to over-specialization. I mean, I described how I've had the luck to be able to, you know, roam through different areas, and I don't warm to philosophers who don't have enough problems, but I worry that just the structure of the discipline is forcing people to focus too exclusively on particular problems and not be generalists, and I think that's a pity.
Is there any... Yeah, so if particular problems, is there any way to bring those particular, like, to zoom in and sort of make them more general? Or, I don't know, do you have maybe an example of kind of what you would like to see happen?
So, I mean, if there's a way of remedying it, maybe it's to do with journal policies, kinds of things journals want. I mean, to get a paper published in a journal now, you have, I mean, they want you to be adding something to the existing literature. You know, they want you to be able to show that you're a master of the existing literature. Somebody who hasn't established themselves can't just start floating some ideas about some topic just on the grounds that ideas are interesting and worth exploring. They won't get them published unless they can kind of tighten it up, fit it together with what everybody else has said. And I think just off the top of my head, I mean, there might be room for journals that make a point of not requiring such a level of expertise. I think that would lead to more, make it easier for really interesting new ideas to get onto the agenda.
Yeah. Okay. All right. Well, David, thank you so much for taking the time. We'll go in a little bit over time to chat and to detail and elaborate and reflect on your extensive career that has flourished and continues to flourish. Is there anything else you'd like to leave us with, or to say, or to plug, to mention that we didn't quite cover?
I don't think so. If I'm going to plug anything, it's not the last book I wrote, because the last book I wrote was the sporting book, which we have plugged. But a couple of years before that, I wrote a book called Philosophical Devices.
Right. Well, we didn't.
Which I'm rather proud of. It does set theory up to generalized continuum hypothesis. It does analytic a priori and necessary. It does probability theory and correlation and causation. And it does metalogic, including Gödel's theorem, all in about 40,000 words.
Wow.
And it's designed to introduce people who don't have the time or commitment to go through all the details of these technical areas to the interesting results of them. So you asked me to plug something. I'm always keen to plug that. I think it's a very Okay. A very hefty book. But as to anything else, I think we've covered an awful lot of ground. I don't think there's anything that occurs to me.
Okay.
That we left out.
Okay. Well, thank you once again for taking the time this afternoon. Welcome back to England. Hope you have a very nice and pleasant Friday. And hope to speak with you soon. But otherwise, take care and we'll be in touch.
Thanks for hosting me. I enjoyed that a lot.
All right. Thank you very much. Bye-bye.
Bye.